mauve rosebuds at the top of each cup. It was not an observation I would normally have made in my working day. Tina Kennedy's lingerie was not something I wanted to think about, and especially not now. But as she paused by my boss's shoulder to hand him the file of documents he had requested, she bent low and looked straight at me in a manner I could only describe afterwards as challenging. That violet brassiere was sending me a message. That and the moisturized, lightly tanned flesh it contained was a souvenir of my promotion night 2.5 weeks previously. I do not scare easy, but it was the most terrifying thing I had ever seen. In an involuntary gesture, I felt in my pocket for my phone. Vanessa, my girlfriend, had texted me 3 times in the past half hour, even though I had told her that this meeting was of vital importance and not to be interrupted. I had read the first message and tried to ignore the insistent vibration of those that followed. "Don't forget to get Men's Vogue re-suit on page 46. You would look great in the dark one. Kiss, kiss, kiss." "Sweetie, please call me. We need to talk about seat plans." "Important you call me before 2 p.m. as I have to give Gav answer about shoes. Am waiting. Kiss, kiss, kiss." I sighed, feeling the peculiar mix of nagging anxiety and stasis the 2 hours spent in a stuffy boardroom surrounded by other men in suits can bring. "The bottom line, as with all such ventures, is unit capacity. We think we have put together a development plan that will give us the growth potential of the longer-term luxury stay market, with the benefits of a more fluid short-term market, both designed to maximize revenue streams, not just throughout the summer months, but the whole year." The phone buzzed against my thigh, and I wondered absently if it was audible over the sound of Dennis Beaker's voice. I had to hand it to Nessa. She wouldn't give in. She'd seemed barely to hear me this morning when I explained that leaving work mid-afternoon, or, for that matter, calling her, would be difficult. But then she didn't seem to hear much these days except wedding, or perhaps baby. Below, the grey, lead-tarnished length of Liverpool Street stretched away towards the city. I could just see, if I tilted my head, the figures on the pavement, men and women dressed in blue, black or grey, marching smartly along below the sooty masonry to get plastic box lunches that they would gobble at their desks. Some people thought of it as a rat race, but I had never felt like that. I had always felt comforted by the uniformity, the shared sense of purpose, even if that purpose was money. On quiet days, Dennis would point out of the window and demand, "What do you think he earns, eh? Or her?" And we would value them, depending on such variables as cut of jacket, type of shoes, and how straight they stood as they walked. Twice he had sent the office junior running downstairs to see if he had guessed right, and both times, to my surprise, he had. Dennis Beaker says that nothing and nobody on God's earth is without a monetary value. After 4 years working with him, I'm inclined to agree. On the slickly polished table in front of me sat the bound proposal, its glossy pages testament to the weeks Dennis, the other partners, and I had spent clawing this deal back from the brink. Nessa had complained last night, as I checked it yet again for errors, that I was devoting far more energy to that one document than to what she considered our more pressing concerns. I protested, but mildly. I knew where I was with those pages. I was far more comfortable with revenue streams and income projections than with her amorphous, ever-shifting desires for this flower arrangement or that colour-coordinated outfit. I couldn't tell her I preferred to leave the wedding to her. On the few occasions I'd got properly involved, as she had requested, I'd reduced her to hysterics with things I'd apparently got wrong. I couldn't help it. It was as if we were speaking different languages. "So, what I'd like to do now is get my colleague to make a short presentation, just to give you a flavour of what we consider a very exciting opportunity." Tina had crossed to the other side of the boardroom. She stood next to the coffee table, her stance deceptively relaxed. I could still glimpse that violet strap. I closed my eyes, trying to force away a sudden memory of her breasts, pushed up against me in the men's toilets at Bar Brasilia, the fluid ease with which she had removed her blouse. Mike? She was staring at me again. I glanced up, then away, not wanting to encourage her. Mike, you still with us? There was the faintest edge to Dennis's voice. I rose from my seat, shuffling my notes. Yes, I said, and more firmly, yes. I raised a smile for the row of Valence Equities flint-eyed venture capitalists around the table, trying to convey some of Dennis's own confidence and bonhomie. Just, mulling over a couple of points you made. I took a deep breath and gestured across the room. Tina? Lights? I took hold of the remote control device for my presentation, and as my phone vibrated again, wished I had thought to remove it. I fumbled in my pocket to try to turn it off. Unfortunately, glancing up through the dimmed light at Tina, I realized she thought this had been for her benefit. She responded with a slow smile, her eyes dropping to my groin. Right, I said, letting out a breath and refusing resolutely to look at her. I'd like to show you, lucky gentlemen, a few images of what we modestly consider to be the investment opportunity of the decade. There was a low rumble of amusement. They liked me. There they sat, primed by Dennis's raw enthusiasm, ready for my sonorous list of facts and figures. Receptive, attentive, waiting to be reassured. My father often said I was ideally suited to a business environment. He meant business in the grey-suited sense rather than the hyper-sexy mega-deal sense. Because, although I had somehow ended up at the latter end, I had to admit that I was not a natural risk-taker. I was Mr. Due Diligence, one of life's careful, considered deliberators, who researched everything not just to the nth degree, but several degrees beyond. As a child, before I spent my carefully saved pocket money, I would spend hours in a shop weighing up the benefits of Action Man against his compatriots, fearful of the crushing disappointment that came when you made the wrong choice. Offered a choice of puddings, I would pit the potential infrequency of lemon meringue pie against the solid comfort of chocolate sponge and double-check that raspberry jelly wasn't among the options. None of this meant I was unambitious. I knew exactly where I wanted to be, and had long since learnt that taking the quiet path was the key to my success. While colleagues more incendiary careers crashed and burnt, I had become financially secure due to my dogged monitoring of interest rates and investments. Now, 6 years into my tenure at Beaker Holdings, my promotion to junior partner apparently nothing to do with my engagement to the boss's daughter, I was valued as someone who would accurately assess the benefits of any choice, geographical, social, or economic, before making it. Two big deals and I would be senior partner. Another 7 years until Dennis retired, and I would be ready to step into his shoes. I had it all planned. Which was why my behaviour that night had been so out of character. I think you're having your teenage rebellion late, my sister Monica had observed 2 days previously. I had taken her to lunch in the smartest restaurant I knew as a birthday treat. She worked on a national newspaper, but earned less per month than I spent in expenses. I don't even like the girl, I said. Since when did sex have anything to do with liking someone? She sniffed. I think I'll have two puddings. I can't choose between the chocolate and the creme brulee. She had ignored my look. It's a reaction against the wedding. You're trying unconsciously to impregnate someone else. Don't be ridiculous. I almost winced. God, the thought of... All right. But it's obvious you're bucking against something.
bucking.
She grinned. My sister's like that. You should tell Vanessa you're not ready. But she's right. I'll never be ready. I'm not that kind of bloke. So you'd rather she made the decisions? In our personal life, yes, it works well for us like that. So well that you felt the need to shag someone else. Keep your voice down, okay? You know what? I'll just have the chocolate. But if you have the creme brulee, I'll try it. What if she says something to Dennis? Then you're in big trouble. But you must have known that when you copped off with his secretary. Come on, Mike, you're 34 years old, hardly an innocent. I dropped my head into my hands. I don't know what the hell I was doing. Monica had been suddenly buoyant. God, it's nice to hear you say that. You don't know how cheering it is for me to know that you can cock up your life just like the rest of us. Can I tell Mum and Dad? Now, filled with a sudden picture of my sister's triumph, I forgot where I was and had to glance at my notes. I breathed out slowly and looked up again at the expectant faces around me. It seemed to have become uncomfortably warm in the boardroom. I let my gaze settle on their team. No one was even remotely flushed. Dennis always said that venture capitalists had ice in their blood. Perhaps he was right. As Dennis has explained, I continued, the emphasis in this project is on the quality end of the market. The consumers we'll be targeting in this development are hungry for experiences. They are people who have spent the last decade acquiring material goods which haven't made them happy. They are possession-rich, time-poor, and are searching for other ways to spend their money. And the real growth area, according to our research, is in their sense of well-being. To that end, this development will not just offer accommodation of a quality that will ensure it a slot at the top end of the market, but a variety of leisure opportunities suited to the surroundings. I clicked the remote control, bringing up the images that the artist had only delivered that morning, leaving Dennis turbocharging what barely remained of his blood pressure. It will have a state-of-the-art spa with 6 different pools, a full-time therapeutic staff, and a range of the newest holistic treatments. If you turn to page 13, you will see the space itself in more detail, as well as a menu of the kind of thing it will offer. And for those who prefer to get their sense of well-being from something a little more active, and let's face it, that's usually the men. Here I paused for the amused nods of recognition. We have the pièce de résistance of the whole complex, an integrated centre devoted entirely to water sports. This will include jet skis, waveboards, speedboats and water skiing. There will be game fishing. There will also be PADI-trained instructors to take clients on tailor-made diving trips further out to sea. We believe a combination of top-class equipment with a highly skilled team will give clients a never-to-be-forgotten trip and offer them the chance to learn new skills. All while staying in a resort that will be a byword for service and luxury, Dennis put in. Mike, bring up the architect's pictures. As you can see, there are 3 levels of accommodation to suit both the affluent singles and families, with a special penthouse for VIPs. You'll notice we have avoided the budget option. We've already had interest from... I heard you lost the site for this. The voice had come from the back. The room fell quiet. Oh, Christ, I thought. Tina, bring up the lights. It was Dennis's voice, and I wondered if he was about to answer, but he was looking at me. I made my expression bland. I'm good at that. I'm sorry, I didn't catch that, Neville. Did you have a question? I heard this was planned for South Africa, and that you lost your sight. There's nothing on this document about where it's going to be now. You can hardly expect us to consider investing in a holiday resort that has yet to find a site. The flicker in Dennis's jaw betrayed his own surprise. How the hell had they found out about South Africa? My voice cut through the air even before I knew what I was saying. I'm not quite sure where your information has come from, but South Africa was only ever an option for us. Having examined our potential location there in some detail, we decided that it couldn't provide our clients with the kind of holiday we had in mind. We're looking at a very specialized market, and we... Why?
Why what?
Why was South Africa unsuitable? My understanding is that it's one of the fastest-growing holiday destinations in the world.
My Turnbull and Assa shirt was sticking to the small of my back. I hesitated, wondering if Neville had any knowledge of the failure of our previous financing deal.
Politics, interjected Dennis. Politics? It would have been an hour and a half transfer from the airport to the resort, and whatever route we took would have brought us through some of the, well, shall we say, less affluent areas. Our research tells us that when they have paid a premium for a luxury holiday, clients don't want to be confronted by abject poverty. It makes them...
Please don't smile sympathetically at their secretary, I pleaded silently. Too late. Dennis's empathetic beam was as treacly as it was misjudged.
Uncomfortable. And that is the last emotion we want clients to feel at this resort. Joyous, yes. Excited, yes. Satisfied, of course. Guilty or uncomfortable at the plight of their coloured cousins, no.
I closed my eyes. I felt, rather than saw, the black secretary do the same.
No, Neville. Politics and luxury holidays just do not mix.
Dennis shook his head sagely, as if delivering some oracle.
And that is the kind of detailed research on which we at Beaker Holdings pride ourselves before we embark on a major project.
So you have an alternative site in mind?
Not just in mind, but signed and sealed, I said. It's a bit of a departure, but it avoids all the potential minefields of South Africa and other parts of the Third World. It's full of English speakers, it has a superb climate, and it is, I can truly say, one of the most beautiful spots I have ever seen. And in this line of work, Neville, you know as well as I do that there are some very beautiful destinations indeed.
R.J.W. Land had stolen the site from under our noses. Someone there must have tipped off Valance.
My mind raced. If R.J.W. was attempting a similar development, would their people also have approached Valance for funding? Were they attempting to sabotage our deal?
I can't go into more detail, I said smoothly, but I can tell you in confidence that there were other things we discovered about the South African site that suggested much lower future revenues, and as you know, we're all about maximizing profit here.
In truth, I knew almost nothing about the new site. Out of desperation, we had used a land agent, some old mate of Dennis's, and the deal had been closed only 2 days previously. I hated the sensation of flying blind.
Tim, I smiled. You know I'm a boring sod when it comes to research, that there's nothing I like better for my bedtime reading than a pile of analysis. Believe me, if I'd thought the South African site was going to work better in the long run, I wouldn't have been so glad to let it go. But I like to go a layer deeper.
Your bedtime reading is all very interesting, Mike, but it would be useful if...
And it's really all about the margins. That's the bottom line.
No one cares about the margins more than us, but...
Dennis held up a pudgy hand.
Tim, no, not a word.
Because there's something else I'd like to show you before we go any further. In fact, gentlemen, if you'd like to follow me through to the next room, we have a bit of fun lined up before we tell you exactly where it is. Venture capitalists, I mused as we followed them, didn't look as though fun was a high priority on their agenda. Some were positively disgruntled at having been uprooted from their comfort zone of boardroom table and leather-backed chair, muttering uneasily to each other. Then again, having come in half an hour late, I wasn't sure what Dennis had in mind. "Please don't let him have asked Tina to dress up in a bikini," I prayed. I was still haunted by memories of the Hawaiian hula proposal. But what Dennis had planned was quite different. Boardroom 2 had been emptied of its table, chairs, and pull-down screen. There was no two-way video link or a tea trolley in the corner. What sat huge, squat, and foreboding in the centre of the floor was a large piece of machinery, surrounded by inflatable blue tubing, its centrepiece a florid yellow surfboard. We were all stunned into immobility by the sheer unlikeliness of the thing. "Gentlemen, remove your shoes and prepare to hang 10. Dennis held out an arm towards the machine. "It's a simulator," he announced when nobody said anything. "You can all have a go." The room was silent, bar the low hum of the surf simulator. It sat, an alien creature in this sea of grey, its flashing buttons gamely advertising that, should they want it, their surf experience could be accompanied by a Beach Boys tune. I registered their expressions and decided that the best way to rescue the situation was to divert them. "Perhaps the ladies and gentlemen would like a bite to eat first. A drink, perhaps. Tina, would you mind?"
"Whatever you say, Mike," she said, catching my eye lazily.
I could have sworn there was a sway to her walk as she left the room, but Dennis didn't notice.
"I just want to give you gentlemen an idea of how irresistible our proposal is. I had a little go earlier," he said, kicking off his shoes. "It really is quite good fun. If no one else is brave enough, I'll show you how it works. You stand on here and..."
He had removed his jacket, and the barely restrained bulk of his stomach hung over the waistband of his trousers. I was grateful, not for the first time, that Vanessa had inherited her mother's genes.
"I'll start off with some little waves. See? It's easy."
To the strains of "I Get Around," my boss, who in the past 3 years had overseen £70 million worth of property investment, and has on his desk photographs of himself shaking hands with Henry Kissinger and Alan Greenspan, stood on the surfboard. His arms were raised in a parody of athleticism to reveal two dark patches of sweat. His buffoonish exterior was renowned for masking a razor-sharp business brain, although sometimes I had to wonder.
"Switch it on, Mike!"
I glanced at the men behind me, trying to smile. I wasn't sure that this was a good idea. It wasn't the image I thought we should portray.
"Just switch it on at the plug, Mike, and I'll do the rest. Come on, Tim, Neville, you can't pretend you don't want to have a go."
With a low whine, the surfboard jolted slowly into life. Dennis bent his knees and stuck one hand forward, wiggling his fingers.
"What I haven't told you, gentlemen, is that simulators will also be..." "Whoops!"
He struggled to keep his balance.
"There we go. The simulators will be on-site for clients to learn on before they go out on the water. It's a complete package."
Even those who had never been on the water in their lives, he said, gasping with the effort, would be able to practice in private before exposing themselves to the gaze of their fellow holidaymakers. I don't know if it was the bizarre improbability of this machine forming part of the proposal, or Dennis's evident enjoyment, but within a few minutes Even I had to admit that he was winning them over. I watched as Tim and Neville crept closer to the machine, sipping the champagne that Tina had handed to them. Their finance man, a florid heavyweight called Simons, had already taken off his shoes to reveal surprisingly threadbare socks, and the two junior members of their team were quoting at each other from the pages of surfing slang that Tina had prepared. Dennis had imagination. I had to hand it to him.
"What happens if we turn it up, Dennis?"
Neville was smiling. I wondered if that was a good sign.
"Tina has given you a list," he said breathlessly. "I believe I'll be, whoops, catching a pounder."
Neville had moved closer. He took off his jacket and handed his glass to his secretary.
"What level will you go to, Dennis?"
He was, I had guessed, one of nature's competitors. But so was Dennis.
"Any you want, Nev. Turn her up,"
he cried, his face beaded with sweat.
We'll see who can catch the biggest wave, eh?"
"Go on, Mike,"
Neville urged. I smiled. They were all enjoying themselves. As Dennis had guessed, the simulator had drawn away their attention from the South African rumours.
"I've always fancied a bit of the old surf," said Tim,
removing his jacket too. Before them, the simulator whined and juddered under Dennis's weight.
"What level you on there, old chap?"
3, I said, glancing at the dial. "I really don't think..."
"Come on, we can do better than that. Turn him up, Mike. Let's see who can stay on longest." "Yes, turn him up,"
the grey suits of Valence Equity Financing chanted, the veneer of restraint peeled away by amusement. I looked at Dennis, who nodded, then motioned towards the dial.
"Come on, Mike, old boy. Bring on the waves." "You're stoked, Dennis."
Tim was checking the surfing terminology.
"The waves are gnarly, but you're stoked."
Despite his apparent gaiety, Dennis was now sweating profusely. He tried to smile, but I saw a hint of desperation in his eyes as he tried to stay aloft the now rapidly undulating board.
"Want me to take you down a notch, Dennis?" I offered.
"No, no, I'm stoked. How long have I been at level 4, chaps?"
"Take him to 5.
yelled Neville, stepping forward and grasping the dial.
"Let's see how he rides the crunchers."
"I'm not..."
I began. Afterwards, no one was sure how it had happened. Dennis was one of the few people in the room who had not drunk any champagne, but somehow the simulator was booted up to its highest level at the moment when Dennis's balance failed him. With a terrible cry, he was hurled clear of the surrounding inflatable cushions and across the boardroom, more swiftly than someone his size should have been, to land heavily on his hip. It broke, of course. Those who hadn't guessed that the impact would do it heard the sickening crunch. I don't think I'll ever forget that sound. It removed for me even the slender desire I'd felt to try the machine. As I've mentioned, I'm not one of nature's risk-takers. There was pandemonium. Everyone crowded round. Over the exclamations of concern and cries of "call an ambulance," the surfboard gyrated and the Beach Boys sang on.
"Australia, eh?"
said Neville, as Dennis was stretchered towards the lift.
"Unforgettable presentation. We're definitely interested. When you're out of hospital, we'll talk more about the site. Mike will send you a copy of the site report. Won't you, Mike?"
Dennis spoke through clenched teeth, his face grey with pain. "Sure." I tried to look as confident as he had sounded.
As he was loaded into the ambulance, he beckoned me closer.
"I know what you're thinking," he whispered. "You'll have to compile one."
"But the timing, the wedding."
"I'll square it with Vanessa. Best you're out of the way for most of the planning anyway. Book yourself a flight this afternoon. And for God's sake, Mike, come back with a plan that's going to make this site work."
"But we haven't even..."
"I'll stall them as long as it takes for you to pull it together. But this is our biggest ever development. I want to know I was right to promote you, that you can bring it in."
It didn't occur to him that I might refuse, that I might put my personal life before the needs of the company. But then he was probably right. I'm a company man, a safe pair of hands. I booked the flight that afternoon. Business class in one of the Asian carriers was cheaper than economy in both my initial choices.
4. Greg.
"What's an okay time of day to start on the beer?" "According to my old man, any time after midday. He used to sink them like my mother sank cups of tea, cracking open a Tui's every couple of hours or so when he took a break from whatever house he was building. He was a big bloke, and you'd never have known he was drinking that much. My mum reckons that was 'cause he was permanently drunk. Cheerful in the afternoons, ebullient at tea, a little muzzy in the mornings from the night before. We never had the misfortune to deal with him stone-cold sober. I believe the right time is around 2 p.m, unless I'm working, in which case it's whatever time I bring sweet Suzanne back in. You wouldn't catch me drunk at the helm. Whatever my faults, I'd never put my boat or my passengers at risk. But a cold beer at Kathleen's, with the sun high in the sky and a few chips on the table, that'll do me. Can't see how anyone could object to that, apart from my ex. According to Suzanne, there's never a good time for me to drink beer. She said I was a mean drunk, an ugly drunk, and drunk too often to make up for it. She said that was why she could no longer stand the sight of me. She said that was why I was losing my looks. She said that was why we'd never had kids, although she'd refused point blank when I suggested she and I head for the dock to see if he could work it out. And I told her, I might not be an angel, and I'm the first to admit I'm not the easiest bloke to be hitched to. There's not a lot of men in Australia would volunteer to have their tackle tampered with, especially by another bloke. But that was how bad I wanted kids, and that was why, as I left my solicitor's office at 11:25, amazing how you keep track of time when you're paying by the hour and it's Saturday rates, I decided that, as far as I was concerned, 11:25 a.m. was the perfect time to crack open a cold can of VB. Even though it was chilly enough for me to be wearing my sweater and the wind was too high to sit outside without turning blue. I guess that beer must have been a two fingers to her, as much as anything. Her and her bloody fitness instructor bloke and her half share of everything and her stupid demands. Because, to be honest, it didn't taste that great. I was going to drink one at the pub, but somehow, when I thought about it, sitting in a pub by yourself at 11:25 in the morning seemed a little sad, even on a Saturday. So I sat in the front of my truck drinking my beer with a little less speed than I might have done, waiting for the point when it would stop feeling like an effort and start easing the hours along from the inside. I had no customers that day. I'd had to admit my numbers had dropped a lot since I'd graffitied the boat. Liza had helped me paint over it at the weekend and told me briskly that if I kept my mouth shut, everyone would have forgotten about it in a week or two. And I did. I was going to have to work like a bloody dog to pay the kind of settlement that that ex of mine was demanding. A clean break, they called it. The same phrase doctors use when they talk about a snapped limb. And that was how it felt, I can tell you. So painful that if I thought about it too hard, it made me feel physically sick. But for now, I sat in my cab in the car park, thinking of how I had watched the tourists totter down Whale Jetty in their high heels, clutching their video cameras and their whale song CDs, and I, Suzanne, warily, as if she might jump out of the water to reveal some other blasphemy. If I hadn't had other plans that day, I would have taken her out by myself, even after a beer. I'd found that sometimes just sitting in the bay watching the bottlenose made me feel better. They stick their heads up with those stupid old smiles as if they're having a joke with you, and sometimes you can't help but laugh, and even on days when you want to slit your wrists. I guess we were all a bit like that, the crews. We knew that was the best bit, just you and those creatures, out in the silence of the water. At least you didn't have kids, the solicitor had remarked, checking out the joint account. She'd no idea what she'd said. I'd finished the second beer when I saw him. I'd crumpled the tin in my fist and was about to chuck it into the passenger footwell when I clocked him. You couldn't miss him. He stood there in his dark blue pen pusher's suit, flanked by two oversized matching suitcases, gazing back towards the main street. I stared at him until he clocked me back, then stuck my head out of the window. You all right, mate? He hesitated, then picked up his cases and stepped forward. His black lace-up shoes had been polished to within an inch of their lives. Not the kind of bloke I'd normally have got chatting to, but he looked deadbeat, and I guess I felt sorry for him. One deadbeat to another, like. When he reached my window, he dropped the cases and fished a piece of paper out of his pocket.
I think my taxi's dropped me at the wrong place. Can you tell me if there's a hotel near here?
A palm, I might have guessed. I squinted at him. There's a few, mate. Which end of Silver Bay are you after? He glanced at his piece of paper again.
It just says the, Silver Bay Hotel.
Kathleen's place. It's not a hotel as such, not any more.
Is it much of a walk?
I guess curiosity got the better of me. You don't often see men dressed up like a dog's dinner in this neck of the woods. She's away up the road. Hop in. Got a bit of business over there myself. You can sling your bags in the back. I saw doubt pass over his face, as if an offer of a lift was to be mistrusted, or perhaps he didn't want his smart luggage touching my seaweedy gear in the back. This bugged me a little, and I nearly changed my mind. But he dragged his cases round to the tailgate, and I watched him haul them over the side. Then he opened the door and climbed in, struggling as his feet made contact with the pile of empties. "Mind your shoes on those tinnies," I said as I pulled off. "The beer should be long gone, but I can't promise." As a name, Silver Bay is a little misleading. It's not really one bay at all, but two, separated by Whale Jetty, which sticks out on the piece of land that cuts through them. From above, I used to say, the sea looks like a giant blue backside. Suzanne would raise her eyebrows at that, but then she raised her eyebrows at almost everything I said. Kathleen's place sat on one of the bays, the furthest, right at the end, near the point that took you out to the open sea. All that remained on her side, really, was the old Bullen House, the museum, and the sand dunes. The other side of Whale Jetty was McIver's Seafood Bar and Grill, the fish market, and then, as you moved further from Kathleen's, the growing spread of the town. He told me his name was Mike, and I forget his surname. He didn't say much else. I asked him if he was here on business, and he said, pleasure mainly. I remember thinking, what the hell kind of bloke dresses like that on his holidays? He said he'd just got off the plane that morning and he should have had a hire car, but the company had screwed up and said they'd deliver one to him up here from Newcastle tomorrow. Long flight, but, I said. He nodded. Been here before?
Sydney. Once. I wasn't there very long.
I figured he was in his mid-30s. He looked at his watch a lot, for someone who wasn't working. I asked him how he came to be booked into Kathleen's. It's not the busiest, I said, glancing pointedly at his expensive suit. I thought someone like you'd want to be somewhere, you know, smarter. He looked straight ahead, as if he was working out his answer.
I heard the area was nice, he said. It was the only hotel I could find listed.
You really want to be over at the Blue Shoals up the coast there, I said. Pretty nice place, that. En suites, Olympic-sized pool, all that jazz. Monday to Thursday, they do a pretty good all-you-can-eat buffet, too. $15 a head, I think it is. Fridays, the price goes up a bit.
I swerved to avoid a dog that loped across the road. And there's the Admiral in Nelson Bay. Satellite telly in every room. The decent channels, not the crap. You'd get a good deal this time of year. I happen to know there's hardly anyone in there. Thank you, he said eventually. If I decide to move, that may come in useful.
After that, there wasn't much we said to each other. I drove, feeling a bit irritated that the guy hadn't made more of an effort. I'd picked him up, driven him all the way. A cab ride would have cost him a good $10, given him the lowdown on the area, and he made barely any effort to talk to me. I was half thinking of saying something. I guess the beer had warmed me up a little, but then I realised he'd fallen asleep. Out cold. Not even a sharp-suited businessman looks like a winner when he's drooling on his shoulder. For some reason, this made me feel better, and I found myself whistling all the way along the coast road to Silver Bay. Kathleen had done up the table something beautiful. I saw the cloth and the balloons long before I saw anything else. The white damask billowing in the brisk winds, the balloons bobbing in a bid to break free for the heavens. The homemade bunting read, Happy Birthday Hannah. And below it, the birthday girl and a gang of her mates were squealing at some bloke with a snake wrapped round his arm. For a minute I forgot about the visitor in my cab. I climbed out and walked along the driveway, remembering with a jolt that the party had started an hour earlier. Greg! Kathleen had a way of looking you up and down that told you she knew exactly where you were coming from.
Nice of you to make it.
Who's that? I nodded towards the bloke with the snake.
The creature teacher, I believe he calls himself. Every creepy crawly you can imagine. Giant cockroaches, snakes, tarantulas. He lets the kids hold them, stroke them, that kind of thing. It was what Hannah asked for.
She shuddered.
Can't think of anything more disgusting.
In my day, you'd stamp on them, I agreed, with your bluntstones on. There were 8 kids and a few adults, mainly other crew. That didn't surprise me. Hannah was a funny kid, old before her time, and we were all used to her hanging around with us. She had done since she was small. It was good to see her with some kids her own age. Apart from that girl, Lara, I hardly ever saw her with one. You'd forget how young she was half the time. Liza said she was like that, a bit solitary. I sometimes wondered whether she was talking about Hannah or herself. Kathleen handed me a cup of tea and I took it, hoping she couldn't smell the beer and my breath. It didn't seem right, somehow, at a child's party. And I was very fond of that kid.
Your boat's a bit prettier now, Kathleen grinned.
I suppose you know Liza helped me to repaint her name.
That temper of yours'll get you into trouble, she tuttered. Old enough to know better, I'd say.
Is this you telling me off, Kathleen?
You're not that drunk, then.
One, I protested. Just one.
Okay, maybe 2.
She glanced at her watch.
And it's just after midday. Well, good for you. You've got to hand it to the shark lady. She tells it as she sees it. Always has, always will. Not like Liza. She looks at you as if there's a whole other conversation going on in her head, and when you ask her what she's thinking, like a woman, that's what she reduces you to, she'll shrug as if nothing's going on at all.
Hi, Greg.
Hannah ran past, beaming. I remember that feeling. When you're a kid and it's your birthday, and for one day everyone makes you feel like the most special person in the world. She paused just long enough to clock the little parcel under my arm. She's an angel, that girl. But she's not stupid. Oh, this is for your Aunt Kathleen, I said. She stopped right in front of me, mischief in her eyes.
How come it's got kids' wrapping paper?
She said. It has?
It's for me,
she ventured. Are you saying your Aunt Kathleen's too old for this paper? I put on my best innocent face. It had never worked with Suzanne either. She stared at it, trying to work out what it might be. She's not the kind of kid to snatch. She's cautious, thinks before she acts. I couldn't bear making her wait any longer, so I handed it over. I have to admit, I was quite excited myself. She ripped it open, flanked by her friends. They were all growing up, I noticed, losing the skinny little legs and the chubby cheeks. In a couple, you could already see the women they would become. I had to fight my sadness at the thought that some would end up like Suzanne, dissatisfied, nagging, faithless.
It's a key,
she said, puzzled, as she held it aloft.
I don't get it.
A key? I said, making myself look confused. Are you sure?
Greg?
You sure you don't recognise it? She shook her head. It's the key to my lockup. She frowned, still not getting it. The one by the jetty. Darn, I must have left your present in there. You and your mates might want to scoot down and check. They were gone before I could say another word, feet kicking up in the sand, all squeals and sneakers. Kathleen gazed at me quizzically, but I said nothing. Sometimes you just want to savour the moment, and these days I get precious few to savour. Within minutes, they were sprinting back up the path.
Is it the boat? Is it the little boat?
Her cheeks were flushed. Her hair mussed round her face. I lost my breath. She was so much like a mother. Did you check the name? I said.
Hannah's Glory,
she told her Aunt Kathleen breathlessly.
It's a blue dinghy, and it's called Hannah's Glory. Is it really for me?
Sure is, Princess, I said. That smile nixed my crappy morning. She threw her little arms round me, and I hugged her right back, unable to stop myself beaming.
Can we take it out? Can I take it out, Auntie Kay?
Not right now, sweetheart. You've got your cake to cut, but I'm sure you can sit in it in the lock-up.
I could hear her excited chatter the whole way down the path. A boat. Kathleen turned to me, one eyebrow arched, when Hannah was out of earshot. You talk to Liza about this?
Not yet. The kids were skipping back to my lock-up. But I think I'm about to get my chance.
She was striding towards me, holding a plate with the birthday cake on it, the little dog at her heels. She was beautiful. As always, she looked like she'd meant to head for somewhere else. But at the last minute, she'd decided to stop by you,
As a favour, you understand.
Hi. I've been hanging that bit of baleen on her wall. Over her bed she wants it.
She nodded a greeting at me.
Stinks to high heaven. She's got 4 books on dolphins, 2 on whales and a video. She'll be opening her own museum at this rate. You've never seen a room so full of dolphin tat.
She straightened.
Where are the kids off to?
You might want to talk to Greg about that, said Kathleen. Then she walked off, one hand raised, as if she didn't want to be around for the next bit. They're checking out my present. She put the plate on the table.
Oh, yes? What did you get?
She began to whip the cling film off the sandwiches. Old Carter was selling it. Little sculling craft. I've rubbed it down, given it a lick of paint. It's in perfect nick. It took her a minute to register what I'd said. She stared at the table for a moment, then looked up at me.
You got her a what?
A little boat, of her own. I thought once she'd had a few lessons, she can go and see the bottlenoses with the mates.
I was a bit unnerved by her expression, so I added, she's going to have one eventually.
She put her hands up to her mouth, a little like she was praying. She seemed something less than grateful.
Greg?
Yeah?
Are you out of your tiny mind?
What?
You bought my daughter a boat? My daughter who isn't allowed out on the water? What the hell did you think you were doing?
Her voice was blistering. I stared back at her, unable to believe she was so mad. I was giving the kid a birthday treat.
It's not your place to give my kid a birthday treat.
She lives on the water. All her mates have little boats. Why shouldn't she have one?
Because I've told her she can't.
Why? What harm can it do? She's got to learn, hasn't she?
She'll learn when I'm ready for her to learn.
She's 11 years old. Why are you so mad? What the hell is this about? When she didn't answer, I gestured towards Hannah, who was standing at the door of the lockup. Look at her. She's pleased as punch. I heard her telling her mates it was the best birthday present she'd ever had. She wouldn't listen, just stood in front of me yelling.
Yes, so now I've got to be the wicked witch who tells her that she can't accept it. Thanks a bunch, Greg.
So don't. Let her have it. We'll mind her.
We?
It was then that Mike appeared. I'd forgotten about him, asleep in my cab some time ago. But now he was standing there, a little awkward, his suitcases in hand, his face still crumpled from sleep. I could cheerfully have told him to get lost. Not that Liza noticed. She was still raging.
You should have asked me, Greg, before you butted in trying to buy a little girl's love with a bloody boat. The one thing I've been telling her for the past 5 years she is not allowed to have.
It's just a little rowing boat. It's hardly a bloody 200-horsepower speedboat. She was making me mad now. It was as if she was accusing me of trying to harm the kid.
Excuse me, can I just...
She held up a hand, still facing me.
Just butt out of my life, okay? I've told you 12 times I don't want a bloody relationship with you, and you sucking up to my daughter isn't going to change that.
We fell silent as the words settled around us. By God, she'd known that would sting. Sucking up? I could hardly bear to repeat the words. Sucking up? What bloody kind of man do you take me for?
Just go away, Greg. I'm really sorry to interrupt, but...
Mum!
Hannah was standing beside the English bloke, her birthday smile wiped clean off her face.
She looked from me to her mum and back again.
Why are you shouting at Greg?
She spoke quietly and carefully, her eyes wide, as if we had frightened her. Liza took a deep breath.
If someone could point me towards reception?
Mike looked as if he wanted to be there even less than I did. Suddenly, Liza noticed our extra guest. She turned towards him, face still flushed with anger.
Reception? You want to speak to Kathleen? Over there. Lady in the blue shirt.
He tried to smile, muttered something about an English accent, and after a brief pause disappeared. Hannah was still standing next to me. Her sad little voice, when it came, made me want to give that mother of hers a slap.
I suppose this means I'm not allowed to keep the boat?
When Liza turned to me, the full force of every bad thought she had ever had hit me square on. It wasn't a pretty feeling.
We'll talk about it, lovey, she said.
Liza, I tried to keep my voice nice for the kid's sake. I never meant to.
I'm not interested, she cut in. Hannah, tell your friends it's time for the cake.
When Hannah didn't move, she waved an arm.
Go on, and I'll see if we can light some candles. It's not going to be easy in this breeze.
I put my hand on Hannah's shoulder. Your boat will be waiting for you in the lock-up whenever you're ready, I said, hearing the defiance in my voice. And then I walked stiffly away, muttering words I'm not proud of under my breath. Yoshi met me at the truck.
Don't go, Greg, she said. You know how worked up she gets about stuff. Don't ruin Hannah's day.
She was still holding a party bag. She'd sprinted down from the kitchen to stop me. It wasn't me ruining it, I wanted to say. It wasn't me determined to stop my little girl doing the one thing she wanted most in all the world. It wasn't me who acted like the kid's childhood was normal but never talked about any family other than Kathleen. It wasn't me who 3 or 4 times a year would be all over her like a rash and the next day act as if I was something she'd picked up on the back of her shoe. I know when I'm guilty, and I also know that sometimes it simply isn't my fault. Tell her I've got a boat to take out, I said, more sourly than I'd intended. I felt bad afterwards. It had nothing to do with Yoshi, after all. But I wasn't going out on the water. I was going to head for the nearest bar and drink until someone was good enough to tell me we'd made it into the next day.
5. Kathleen. It's hard to believe now, given the size of our land, but whaling was once one of Australia's primary industries. From way back in the 19th century, whaling ships would come from Britain, unload a few convicts on us, then load up with some of our whales and sell them back to us at our ports. Some exchange, as Nino said. The Aussies got wise in the end and caught their own. After all, you could use a whale for just about anything. The oil for lamp fuel, candles and soap. The baleen for corsets, furniture, umbrellas and whips. I guess there was a lot more call for whips in those days. Back then, the whalers mainly hunted the southern right whale. They called it right because it was so darn easy to catch. That poor beast was about the slowest thing in the southern hemisphere, and once dead, it would float so that they could tow it into shore. I reckon it could only have made it easier for those whale chasers if it had harpooned itself and swum to the processing plant. They're protected now, of course, what remains of them. But I remember as a girl seeing one towed into the bay by 2 small boats. It seemed wrong to me even then, as I watched the huge swollen belly hauled inelegantly onto the shore, the blank eye gazing balefully up to the heavens as if despairing at man's inhumanity. I would catch just about anything. Even as a little girl, my father would boast, I could hook, land and gut with an efficiency that might have been construed as heartless. But the sight of that southern right made me cry. Here on the east coast, there hadn't been the whaling madness that we'd heard of out west. Here, fewer whales were taken before the end of the war, except in our little corner. Perhaps because the whales came so close that you could see them from dry land, this bay became a base for whale chasers. Our whale-watching crews have inherited their nickname. When I was a girl, they had killed them from small boats. It seemed like a fair fight, and it kept the catch down. But then they got greedy. Between 1950 and 1962, some 12,500 humpbacks were killed and processed at stations like Norfolk Island and Moreton Island. Whale oil and meat made people rich, and the whale chasers used more and more sophisticated weaponry to increase their catch. The ships became bigger and faster, and the haul a plentiful, grim harvest. By the time humpback whaling was banned in Australian waters, they were using sonars, guns and cannon-launched harpoons. The equipment of war, my father said in disgust. And of course they killed too many. They swept those oceans until there was near none left of the humpbacks and put themselves out of business in the process. One by one the whaling operations closed. The processing plants shut down or converted to seafood processing. The area sank back slowly into shabby solitude, and most of us were relieved. My father, who had loved the romanticism of early whaling, back when it was about man versus whale, rather than whale versus Penthrite charge grenade, bought Silver Bay's own whale processing plant and turned it into the museum. Nowadays, the scientists reckon there might be fewer than 2,000 humpbacks come past us on their annual migration, and some say the numbers will never recover. I tell this story to the crews occasionally, when they talk about getting a bigger fleet, or trying to up their passenger numbers, of whale-watching as the tourist attraction of the future, the way to rejuvenate Silver Bay. There's a lesson in there for us all. But I'm darned if anyone's listening. Good afternoon. Afternoon. Michael Dormer hovered in the doorway, wearing the dazed expression of someone whose body clock was insisting he was in the wrong hemisphere. I knocked earlier and left a cup of coffee outside your room, but when I found it stone cold an hour later, I figured I'd let you sleep. He looked like he wasn't taking in what I was saying. I gave him a minute and motioned to him to sit at the kitchen table. I don't normally let people sit in the kitchen, but I'd just finished preparing the dining room for that evening. I placed a plate and a knife in front of him. They say it usually takes a week to sleep through properly. Did you wake up much? He rubbed at his hair. He was unshaven and wearing a shirt and casual trousers. Still smarter than we were used to in Silver Bay, but a good step forward from the formal get-up he'd arrived in. Only once. He smiled a little ruefully. But that was for about 3 hours. I laughed and poured him a coffee. He had a good face, Mr. Michael Dormer, the kind that suggested a little self-knowledge, an attribute I find in short supply in many of my guests. Like some breakfast? I'm happy to fix you something. At 1:45? He glanced at the clock. We can call it lunch. It'll be our secret. I still had some pancake batter in the fridge. I'd serve them with blueberries and a side order of eggs and bacon. He stared at his coffee for a bit, stifling a yawn. I said nothing, but pushed the newspaper towards him, recognising that his disorientation would ease off after a mug or two of caffeine. I moved quietly, half an ear on the radio, distantly calculating the food I needed to prepare for supper that evening. Hannah was at a friend's house after school, and Liza ate barely enough to feed a fly, so it was only the guests I had to worry about. The pancakes were done. Mr. Dormer perked up a bit when I put a plate in front of him. "Wow," he said, staring at the stack. "Thank you." I'd bet he didn't get much in the way of home cooking. They're always the most grateful. But he ate like most men here do, with enthusiasm and a kind of single-mindedness I don't often see in women. My mother always said I ate like a man, but I don't think it was a compliment. While he had his head down, I had the chance to look him over. We don't get many men of his age on their own. Usually they're with wives or girlfriends. The single ones stick to the busier resorts. I'm a little embarrassed to admit that I looked at him in the way I always look at men who might be suitable for Liza. No matter how hard she protests, I've not yet given up hope of pairing her off. "Whales don't stick together for life," she would scoff. "And, as you always say, Kathleen, we should learn from the creatures around us." She had an answer for everything, that girl. The one time I'd remarked that it would be good for Hannah to have a father figure, she'd glared at me with such anguish and reproach that I'd felt instantly ashamed. I'd never brought up the subject again. But that didn't mean I couldn't live in hope. That was delicious, really. "A pleasure, Mr. Dormer." He smiled. "Mike, please." Not as formal as he seemed then. I sat down opposite him, giving myself a coffee break as I refilled his mug. "Got any plans for today?" I was going to point him towards the leaflets in the front hall, but I wasn't sure he was the amusements and day trip to the tea gardens type. He looked down at his coffee. "Just thought I'd get my bearings, really. My hire car should arrive later, so there's not much I can do till then." "Oh, there's lots of places you can go when you've got wheels, but you're right. The bus goes to Port Stephens from up the road, but apart from that, you'd be pretty stuck. Did you say you were here on holiday?" A curious thing. He flushed a little. "Something like that," he said. I left it there. I know not to pursue someone who doesn't want to talk. He might have his own reasons for being here. A broken relationship. A personal ambition. A decision to be made in solitude. I can't bear those people who rattle on and on with questions. Mike Dormer had paid me for a week in advance, thanked me politely for his breakfast, and those two things alone entitled him to my professional courtesy. I'll leave you to it, then," he said, placing his knife and fork neatly on his plate and rising from the table. "Thank you very much, Miss Mostyn." "Kathleen." "Kathleen." I went to clear his plates without another thought.